listening to episode 150 of Flick Fights, the official podcast of FlickChart.com. Hello, Flick Charters, and welcome to Flick Fights, the official Flick Chart podcast. I'm your host, Nathan Chase.
I'm Hannah Kiefer.
And I'm Doug Van Hollen.
And we're here to sort through the best movies of all time, two at a time, head to head. And as we pick the better film between each pair, our chart better represents all of our collective taste in movies. If you're not already on Flick Chart, head over to FlickChart.com, sign up absolutely for free, and get started by ranking all your favorite movies on an account of your very own. On this episode, we're going to be spending some time talking all about the Oscars and all the films nominated for an Academy Award through the years. So let's go ahead, dive right in, and get into some matchups in the Thunderdome.
Two men, hand to hand. No jury, no appeal, no parole. Two men enter, one man leaves.
Weapons?
Anything is possible. Chance decides.
Thunderdome. How do I get in there?
That's easy. Pick a fight.
Okay, so the first Academy Award nominated matchup we have here is The Godfather Part 2 against Munich. So Munich is the 2005 Steven Spielberg film about the weirdness with the Olympics and people getting murdered and all of this kind of almost like a spy film, but not because it's actually a true story. Really well shot, great cinematography. One of Spielberg's underrated films, I'd say. And then on the other hand, we've got Godfather Part II, which has been heralded as one of the best sequels, expanding and sort of gigantic scopes widening of the Godfather story, and it also brought Al Pacino and Robert De Niro together and sort of told the widening of the beginnings of the Corleone family and how it came to be how he came to be the Godfather and how it came to be the story of this particular mob family. I'm not that hot on the Godfather films. Generally, I think they're fine films. I don't think they're the be all end all greatest things of all time that others seem to put them on the pedestal of. And I was actually quite taken with Munich. I think it was really, really well crafted, really interesting in the sense that it doesn't feel like your typical Spielberg. It feels more raw and visceral, but it still has incredibly well thought out and planned and executed scenes throughout the film. It's got a lot of emotional weight. I don't know. What did you guys think of these? Which one's the better one?
I believe I have talked before on the show about how I don't get the Godfather movies. I know that they look great. They have some really great music, but I don't find these characters compelling in any way. And I don't, especially the second one, which is, I probably like the second one more than the first, but the second one is even more character study more than the first. And I just don't care. And I wish I did, because I think there are aspects of it that are just really, really well done. And I wish I cared about it as a whole, but I really don't. Munich, I think, is pretty good. It's not amazing, but I think it tends to get overlooked sometimes. And I think it's a pretty solid movie. It It has a good script, and it's interesting. It's nicely paced in building the tension and telling the story in an interesting way. So my vote is going to go toward Munich, but I know that there are film fans out there right now who are very angry with me, and I'm sorry.
Yeah, so both films were nominated for Best Director, Best Picture, and let's see what else. Best Score. And then Munich was nominated for Best Screenplay or Best Adapted Screenplay and Best Film Editing. And then Godfather Part 2 was also nominated for Best Actor, Best Supporting Actor, Best Supporting Actress, Best Adapted Screenplay, Best Art Direction, Best Costume Direction, Costume Design. So lots of stuff all around the board.
I've never really been a huge Munich fan. I mean, I think that what you guys are saying is true, that it's a solid film and that it's well constructed. But what I found was missing was the outrage that I feel when you have a terrorist attack at the Olympics. Like I think that the film, and maybe Spielberg is incapable of expressing kind of an Oliver Stone-ish type outrage at the offensiveness of the crime that is being answered for in Munich. I found it played out like a normal action film, and that the sort of the emotional and political implications of both the original terrorist attack and then the Mossad retribution that takes place later, that those weren't the reason that the film was not memorable for me is that those seemed a little bit unexamined, or maybe just not examined enough for me. I'm a huge fan of all the Godfather films. I don't think that Part 2 is better than the first one, but I do like how sad it is and how slow it is, which is a very brave choice for a gangster film. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's Godfather 2 by a mile for me, but I think I'm outvoted here.
Okay. Well, first up, we're going to have Munich beating Godfather Part 2. Okay, so next up, we've got Les Miserables against The King and I. So two musicals made for the stage, translated to film. Rodgers and Hammerstein versus... who would be the name behind Les Miserables?
That's actually not the musical version.
We're talking about 1935. Yeah,
it's an old one based just solely on the book.
Okay, so yeah, I'm not familiar with either one of these other than the names themselves. I haven't seen them, but I'll go ahead and let you guys hammer this one out.
Yeah, I like both these films a lot. I think that the era that The King and I comes from, 1956, I always find that it distances me a little bit, just partly because of the film aesthetics, the kind of technicolor sweep of them and the melodrama of the acting. So I think in this particular case, I would prefer a more serious, intimate film like Les Miserables, where you have more nuanced performances, like you get out of Charles Laughton. So it's just a little more in alignment with what I'm looking for in a film. I think that there probably is an equivalently intimate version of The King and I that could be made, but I don't think the one with Yul Brynner, as brilliant as it is, I don't think that's the one for me. So I'm voting Les Mis here.
Yeah, this is a little bit of a tough one for me, because these are both stories that have been brought to the screen into various adaptations a couple of times, and both of them, every version I see is, I just find the stories themselves interesting and I find the characters themselves interesting. And so every adaptation of this, of these stories I see are always compelling to me and always kind of draw me in. I think The King and I is definitely by far my favorite Rodgers and Hammerstein musical. it's got the strongest book of a lot of them. Maybe not South Pacific, but it's got one of the strongest scripts, and it's got Yul Brynner with an incredible performance there, and just some really nice songs that are interesting and that play into the characters in a way that not all their others do. And this version of Les Mis is pretty good. It's not as there are so many characters in Les Mis that every adaptation tends to focus on slightly different ones, with Valjean always being the center of most of them. But like, some will focus more on the students revolting, and some will focus more on the Javert Valjean attack, and so this one, I'm trying to remember my thoughts on it at the time when I watched it in comparison to the musical version, which I had just seen a live one of for the first time. I remember liking the movie, but I think I'm going to have to go with The King and I here. I think they're both pretty good. But I think I'm going to split the vote here and go with The King and I. And I'm not sure which one will take it in the Globals.
Right. I mean, The King and I is definitely the more impactful film here. And, you know, maybe just Yul Brynner's performance all on its own is what deserves to make it take the contest.
Is the non-musical rendition of Les Mis considerably different in terms of the tone or the story's sort of impact versus the musical versions?
It's a little bit, just the nature of the musical version tends to make it a little bit more, relational, whereas the non-musical version is a little bit more political, tends to be more about the society at large rather than these individual characters.
Right.
Yeah, that's a good assessment. The musical also gives more voice to the female characters.
For sure. Which I do appreciate.
All right, so it looks like Les Mis is 4,603 and King and I is at 1,740.
Which that Les Mis should be higher, but I'm sure not a lot of people have seen it. It's an older one. Right.
Yep. So King and I is going to take it over Les Mis. Okay, so next up we have my favorite film, Memento, up against Witness for the Prosecution from 1957 with Charles Laughton, Marlene Dietrich. I must confess, I have not seen Witness for the Prosecution. I know it's on the list of heralded films that everyone should see, and it's just still on my list of shame. I'm sure I would like it more than Memento, almost positively. I'm going to let you guys take it again, and you let me know how much better is Witness for the Prosecution than Memento.
No, I go into this liking Memento. I like it quite a lot. But I think Witness for the Prosecution is really an excellent movie. I was just looking up to remember, it is Billy Wilder who directs it, who is so interestingly diverse in the movies that he chose to do. Witness for the Prosecution is it's got such a great script to work off of. It's based on either a play or a short story by Agatha Christie, probably both. She did a lot of adapting of her own stuff, but it's on top of a really, really good script. It's got amazing performances, and it's just one of those fascinating movies that it sometimes gets a little overlooked in, especially looking at like Billy Wilder's big movies that people go for, Sunset Boulevard and Double Indemnity and Some Like It Hot. And he has all these other movies that Witness for the Prosecution, I think, is probably as good as, but it hardly ever gets mentioned in that canon. And I think it really needs more attention. And then we come to Memento, which I like a lot. I think it does some really, really, I know I've said this before on the show, I think it does a very, some very cool stuff matching the theme with the storytelling format, which I think does interesting stuff. And I think it does interesting things ethically with its storytelling. I'm sure Memento is rated higher on my chart. I'm not sure it should be. Because I think Witness for the Prosecution is almost certainly too low. I'm going to vote for, you know what? I'm going to vote for Witness for the Prosecution, because between the two, they're close for me. And between the two of them, I think Witness is the one that doesn't get as much hype as it should. And so I'm going to vote for it. That's going to be my tiebreaker moment here. That's going to make my decision for me.
It's been so funny as I've been sitting here trying to decide how to make this impossible choice. You've essentially been narrating my internal monologue. at every point, it was like, yeah, but then this, and then Billy Wilder, but then, you know, that was really spooky. So obviously, yes, I'm also voting for Witness for the Prosecution.
Yes, because I was.
So I'm... Yeah, right. Clearly, maybe I'm, you know, rationalizing it after the fact or something. I think what's really interesting is we have these two very different film noir films that are being put forth here. I do, and I also think that Memento's ranked higher on my list, and it shouldn't be. Mm-hmm. I think that this gets lost in the Billy Wilder canon, probably because of its. Of its limited scope and its intimacy, that I think that it's not a flashy story, or there's not any of these huge boisterous performances, or you know, a lot of it is its storytelling in a courtroom is really what it is. And it, I also don't know whether it's a play that it's based on, but it feels like a play.
I was going to say it feels theatrical in that sense. Feels stagey,
right? Right. And like, that's wonderful. I think that in the hands of other directors, it would be kind of a slog to sit through. Mm-hmm. But I think that because of, you know, the way that the courtroom scenes are edited together, and then you have incredible performances. I mean, we have it's so weird that we have two Charles Laughton films in a row here. Yeah. But like, I would watch Charles Laughton in anything. I'd watch him order coffee in a coffee shop. Like I just find him like, it's such a fascinating character. Like he does so much acting with his eyebrows and with his shoulders, and like every square inch of this enormous man is a consummate actor. So yeah, I agree. This is an improbable choice for me. But yeah, Witness for the Prosecution, definitely.
Nice. So on your own personal charts, if this particular matchup came up, it might cause a shift in your chart. Yeah,
almost certainly.
Yeah, you're right.
Nice. All right. Witness for the Prosecution is going to beat Memento. All right. Next up, we have A Few Good Men against The Godfather. Now, this is the first film, The Godfather Part 1, the one that started it off. A Few Good Men is Tom Cruise, Jack Nicholson, and Demi Moore. And it's a... military courtroom drama, famous for the "you can't handle the truth" sequence of the film. I would say is probably that line is what the whole film is known for more than anything else. For better or for worse. And then The Godfather, of course, is The Godfather. anyone that's listening knows what The Godfather is and who's in it and all of its quirks and quotes and everything about it. So the question is The Godfather that much better than A Few Good Men? Yeah, probably. It probably is. A Few Good Men is kind of a footnote film, I would say. I mean, it's decent. It's got some good moments, but it's also got a lot of overacting. It's got probably a slightly hackneyed plot in retrospect, and probably doesn't hold up that much like Godfather does. Certainly not in cinematography alone, or maybe score or any number of things. But is anybody else a Few Good Men supporter, or is this going to be a shutout?
Yeah, I mean, if A Few Good Men is is fine. Like, I think that it's a film that needed to be made. I think it asked some very interesting questions about military ethics, and also the legal side of the military is an interesting little world to spend some time in, that probably we need to see more often. It's not as remarkable and astonishing as The Godfather is. It certainly does not hold up as well. It feels very glossy and early 90s, the way that The Godfather, unlike the way that The Godfather feels completely timeless. This is not that tricky for me.
I'll go ahead and toss a vote toward A Few Good Men. This is this is one that's entirely coming down to personal biases and preferences, where I feel this is one where I feel more guilty about this vote than I did Munich, because A Few Good Men is dated. It feels it is not. I don't think it's as good a film as Munich is, but it ties into so many of my like personal things that I love. It was also based on a play, and it's got this it's got this Aaron Sorkin dialogue, which I just could listen to for days, and it's a courtroom drama, which I really love. And so there are all these little personal favorites that come together to make a movie that I would rather watch than The Godfather. I will say I think Godfather is probably a better movie, but my personal ranking philosophy is not better movie, but the one I prefer. And so I'm going to go for A Few Good Men here, but I'm secretly kind of glad that The Godfather is winning because it probably deserves to.
Right. It's interesting. I never knew this, but Rob Reiner is the director of A Few Good Men. I had no idea. And it seems like such a strange pairing, given all of the other types of movies that he's done. Strange. That Rob Reiner is the director. Both films are nominated for Best Picture. The Godfather is going to beat A Few Good Men. Okay, so next up we have two post-apocalyptic dystopian films. We've got WALL-E and we've got Children of Men, both Academy Award nominated films. WALL-E is the 3D Pixar robot love story that is mostly silent for the majority of its first half. And then it kind of gets into a sort of silly climax and ending, but very polarizing film, I'd say. There are some that feel like it's a very kind of anti-human and very leftist sort of point of view movie. So it has a sort of political slant to it. And then on the other hand, we've got Children of Men, which is it's kind of a hard film to describe. It's very well shot. It's the one of the film. What's his name? Director is escaping me at the moment. It's the director of Gravity and Alfonso Cuarón.
Yes. It's a Spanish name. What is it?
It's a story about the world without pregnancy, and it's science fiction, but not really. And it's just kind of an all around strange film, and it probably warrants several viewings to fully wrap your head around what's actually going on. But it looks great. I think for me, I probably have WALL-E higher on my chart than Children of Men, but probably not by much. I'm not, super crazy on either one of them. So I would say they're probably both in the 400 to 600 range or something like that for me. I would, if I had to take a guess, I don't know. What do you guys think of these films?
I like both of these films a lot. I think it's fun that we did get to post-apocalyptic stories. And these are both really bleak futures. These are both if I think of a lot of post-apocalyptic stories, there seems to be quite a bit more hope for the future of humanity and the earth than there is in these. And yet both of them have and with sort of with a hopeful theme running through them of maybe there's the possibility of rebuilding and of fixing things. I think the first half of WALL-E is one of the most phenomenal things Pixar has ever done. It's the fact that they did choose to do almost a silent film for the entire introductory portion of this story was really interesting and really exciting for a big name animation studio. I could see a smaller group, a smaller indie studio doing something like that, but for this big company, that their whole thing is that they know that they can get the money that they need to be able to keep this going. I think that was just a really cool creative choice, and I love it. The second half is not as exciting, just because it's not as it's not quite as bold as that first move, but I think the first time I saw it was disappointed by the ending, but I think the two of them actually work together really well. Children of Men is really good and really interesting, and I think tells a really cool story, and I just don't think it's not as exciting to me on a storytelling level as WALL-E is, and so I think I'm gonna go for WALL-E.
I've always felt bad that WALL-E has never gone beyond appreciation for me. I can appreciate it and I think it's beautiful, but for some reason it just never connected with me emotionally the way that some of the other Pixar films have. I mean, it's on paper, WALL-E is absolutely my kind of film. But it just didn't hit for me the way that Children of Men definitely did. There is a sense of there's a sense of depression about Children of Men that manages to avoid being nihilism. That, you know, when we're watching Clive Owen live in this world, we don't, even though it looks like his character has given up, he is able to communicate that he is sad, but he is still searching. And a lot of the performances in there, including the one from Michael Caine, have sort of these multiple levels to them that I think that part of it is the director able to extract those sorts of performances out of the actors. I think that may be part of it. I think that the other component of the brilliance of Children of Men is the way that the violence is filmed and the way that we have, very tight handheld cameras in the midst of violence. And then we also have these really tender scenes with the woman and the birth, all the scenes with Michael Caine, just with such a focus on beauty. And so in this film, we kind of we're able to see sort of ugliness and beauty and pain and fear. We're kind of getting the whole range of human emotions. And though it is an unpleasant story to kind of sit through, I definitely connect with it more. So I'm going Children here.
Yeah. Yeah. It kind of feels to me like a corollary between Children of Men and something like Lost in Translation, where it kind of puts you in a mood piece of a film. Uh-huh. Like it's not really as important what the story and narrative is trying to convey as it is trying to just put you in a place and time and sort of make you feel what the characters are feeling.
Right.
At least that's how it kind of struck me. Whereas WALL-E is definitely much more of a direct, straightforward kind of plot and narrative in terms of, even though there isn't as much dialogue, it tells a lot of story just from the physical interactions of Fuali and Eve and all of the things that they have to go through. I think there's emotional weight in both of them, but somehow the robots made me love them more than the sort of it did feel like nihilism to me in Children of Men. It felt I didn't see it as much of a love and hope story as you did. I think it's I don't know.
I think for me, Children of Men, the ending, there's even though there is this hope,
right?
It felt like much more of a long shot than I mean, and Wally, you know, helpfully gives you credits that indicate that they come, you know, they things work out, but Children of Men, even as things finished and I felt like a little bit of hope, it did feel more for me overwhelmingly dark and depressing, and like I was not convinced that was going to work, and I was not convinced that this was going to save humanity. Yeah. But I think I like it. I like seeing it as more as very much a mood piece, because that's definitely what I came away from it with. And I like it.
Maybe Wally is just the Children of Men for children.
Oh, dear.
Yes.
Okay. So Wally is going to beat Children of Men. Okay. So next up we have War Horse and Hugo, both films from 2011. And both Best Picture noms that year. So Hugo is the 3D film from Martin Scorsese about some kids and a clockwork automaton robot thing. and also a story about film and Georges Méliès and kind of a whimsical story. War Horse is, I don't want to just say it's about a horse because it's about a lot more than just that, but, it's a story of war, but told through the lens of a man kind of his journey through the war and also coming back to his relationship with this particular horse. And, Steven Spielberg film, another underrated Spielberg film, I'd say, next to Munich. I loved War Horse. It's visually spectacular. Some people don't like it because they think it's maybe too saccharine, like it's overly sentimental. But I found it to be incredibly well put together and just riveting. One of the most cinematic movies that I think I've seen in the last 10 years. I really feel like the visuals alone make that movie work in ways that a lot of other films don't even come close to. Whereas Hugo, I felt mostly bored. not really excited, not really impressed with the choices in what the Cameron was doing, and the story kind of went all over the place a little bit, and I didn't really connect to the characters that well, which is all very strange to me for all being a Martin Scorsese film, because usually he's great at all that stuff. But for this one, it didn't really work for me. But what do you guys say?
Yeah, Hugo, I thought I was going to love so much more than I did. I like Martin Scorsese, and it looked like a really visually exciting and creative film. Mm-hmm. And it was just, it was about 45 minutes longer than it needed to be. And it wasn't as fun as I wanted it to be. Mm-hmm. And it was another movie that about movies, right. But like trying to pretend it wasn't. And so I was disappointed by Hugo. War Horse, my War Horse story is that when I went and saw it in the theaters 5 minutes before the movie started, I got some mildly bad news. Everything eventually was fine, but like I was in a shaky emotional state as I watched it, and I sobbed my whole way through the movie. Oh, like wow. every moment where there was like an emotional tug at my heart, I was just like, I lost it. And so like I came out of it like incredibly like emotionally I was ready to go on that emotional journey with the horse, which normally I do not think I would have been. So it's sometimes difficult for me to separate the actual thoughts on War Horse from my extremely emotional experience with it.
Right.
I think though that even if I had not had that spectacularly up and down journey there, I think I still would have appreciated and enjoyed the story of War Horse more than I did Hugo. Partly because my expectations for War Horse were fairly low. I thought it was going to be not a horse person. And a lot of times horse movies seem to be very specifically tailored to horse people. Mm-hmm. And this one really isn't. This one really does a better job of tying it to just... to more universal human experiences and emotions, which I really appreciated. And so I think even trying to separate myself from the experience of seeing the theater, I do think that I would have that I would still have appreciated War Horse more than I did Hugo, partly because Hugo had such huge expectations and such huge potential and just didn't live up to any of it. So I think I'm going to join you, Nathan. I think I'm going to vote for War Horse.
I officially have to abstain. I haven't seen War Horse. I saw the play and was so disappointed and annoyed by it that I have avoided the film. I was also disappointed and annoyed by Hugo. So I'm actually kind of glad I don't have to like make such a terrible choice here.
Oh, geez. I would implore you to give War Horse the film a shot. I feel like I don't know why it got so sort of overlooked and poo-pooed when it came out. It was just so good, and maybe it's like you said, Hannah, that people they hear the name and they check out immediately, even from just the title.
Yeah.
Like I don't want to go see the Black Beauty or whatever, you know, this you know cornball movie about a horse is, and it's absolutely nothing like that. I went into it just like it's a new Spielberg film. I'm going to go see it in the theater. And it surpassed every expectation I had by a mile. So, okay. So War Horse is going to beat Hugo. Okay. So next up we have Black Narcissus from 1947 up against, is it Kagamusha? Mm-hmm. Is that correct?
All right. I think so, yes.
From 1980, a Kurosawa film. I believe these are both Best Picture nominees, maybe also Best Picture winners. I'm not sure. I'd have to look it up. But
not winners for sure.
Not winners. Okay. I'm only tangentially familiar with these just by name. I have not seen either one, but... you guys have, so I will let you discuss which one of these is the better film.
I like both these films. I think that Black Narcissus was a very difficult story to tell. Anytime that you have a story about any kind of opaque community such as the you know, India in the 40s or a nunnery, then it becomes very interesting to get some insight into it. We have a story that involves both of those things. It's a very kind of a brave story to tell, and the cinematography is maybe some of the most beautiful cinematography I've ever seen. Certainly in the 40s.
Mm-hmm. There's some, that's what it got nominated for, was Best Cinematography. Oh,
then that's a no-brainer.
It makes total sense.
Yeah, I mean some of the landscape shots just absolutely make your mouth water. I am by default more of a Kurosawa guy anyway. Kagemusha's the plot of it involves, you know, a thief needing to be the double for a samurai warlord, and then the warlord dies, and then the thief has to keep pretending to be the warlord, and you kind of have like, it's sort of like the Prince and the Pauper, except in with samurai and
in feudal Japan.
Feudal Japan, and like the stakes are like really super high.
Right.
Yeah. So I'm voting Kagemusha here. I think that the you know, the emotions tend to just run hotter in Kurosawa films. That's certainly the case here.
I like Kurosawa a lot, but one of the things that I like most about him is his ability to take these big stories and really bring out the small human intimate moments in each one of them. And, and so movies like Seven Samurai, which are 3.5 hours long, still feel like, I still feel like I got to know these characters and that it was a story about them, and I got to like have a stake in what was going on. I never quite feel that with Kagemusha. It's one of my lowest ranked Kurosawas because it feels a little distant and a little cold to me. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure exactly what that is, whether it was a filming thing or whether it was a story thing. It was one of those things where I just came away with a sense of it and couldn't quite pinpoint what filming choice or script choice or whatever had led to that distancing for me. Because I went in expecting to love it and came away feeling feeling the distance that I often feel when trying to attempt a classic foreign cinema, and Kurosawa usually like pushes right past that for me, and so it was a little disappointing that Kagemusha did not. Black Narcissus is a weird, bizarre, amazing movie. It's so strange, and it's so there's so much melodrama, but in a really kind of fascinating, almost gothic kind of way, where it's really playing with this. The cinematography is incredible. I remember individual images from that still, and it's been years since I saw it. I like that it's got this weird dark story that it's trying to tell, and although it's another one where I came away with a strong sense of it and couldn't, and felt very strong things about it. And it was largely because it just had this sense of heightened. Yeah. Melodrama, I think, is exactly the word I want here. But in a way that felt more, just like a heightened sense of emotion rather than something that felt it never quite crossed over into cheesiness for me in the way that a lot of melodramas of the time did.
Yeah, that's true. It could so easily have gone too far, and it did.
It could have, and it keeps, I don't know, I don't know, it keeps itself grounded just enough that everything's a little bit turned up, but not enough to make me roll my eyes at it. And I really like that. I like that when it can push it further than full realistic reality, but keep it from going over that line. And so I didn't come out of Kagemusha with nearly as much as I wanted to. I'm definitely voting Black Narcissus here.
All right. So then we got to go to the globals. See, Kagemusha was nominated for Best Foreign Language Film and Best Art Direction.
Nice.
So,
yeah. So both of them looking at visual
anything
stuff.
Anything where you have 10,000 samurai costumes in order to direct, I think art direction is certainly mm-hmm. a component of that.
Okay, so Kagemusha has a global ranking of 504. And Black Narcissus has a global ranking of 251.
Wow.
Just really outside of the top 250.
That's higher than I would have expected.
Yeah, me too. I mean, it's such a sausage fest around here. I really would have thought that thought that Kagefish should have been higher. So that's great. No, I let the nuns win.
All right. So Black Narcissus is going to beat Kagemusha. All right. Our last matchup for this episode is going to be Star Trek Into Darkness against Skyfall. These are both sequels in the modern reboot of long-running franchises. Skyfall was most definitely nominated for Best Cinematography, and then Star Trek Into Darkness was nominated probably for Special Effects, if I had to guess.
I'm sure if Skyfall got a song nomination too.
Yeah, that's true. It did.
Probably so. I think I saw only Star Trek Into Darkness in the movie theaters, but I did see both of these, and I kind of wish I had seen Skyfall in the theaters because, man, it is a gorgeous movie.
It was nominated for cinematography, apparently.
Yeah, yeah. It's what, Star Trek Into Darkness was nominated for cinematography?
No, Skyfall was.
Oh, Skyfall, yeah. Skyfall might be the best looking James Bond movie ever made. It's not a good movie necessarily. Like the plot is a little bit weak and it's not nearly as good as, say, Casino Royale, but visually it's top notch. I mean, there are so many great color choices and framing choices and just the scenery and sets and I don't know. It's like a movie tailor made to be forever used as a 4K Blu-ray HDR test bed disc. You know, it's like it's that good. It's just like the visual bar has been set.
Right. A lot of credit has to go to the country of Scotland, though.
Yeah, Scotland's a beautiful place.
Yes.
Yeah.
Star Trek Into Darkness, I felt, was kind of weak. It's trying to be Khan, but not, and it's just didn't work. They tried to pull a Khan that nobody was conned by.
A con.
Yeah, the con. And it just kind of felt weird. It didn't feel like Star Trek, and it felt like it was too on the nose and too much of a fan service movie or something. And Spock felt strange. Like Spock is not supposed to be like on the top of a ship going through a city, punching somebody, you know, like in a big action sequence. That's not Spock. It's not the character, right? I don't care if it is this weird rebooted alternate universe Star Trek. It's still the wrong thing anyway. So I think Skyfall will win for me just on the visuals alone. It's worth seeing just to see the movie.
Yeah, these are this is an interesting matchup here. I am typically more of a Star Trek fan than a James Bond fan, but I'm gonna vote the other way this time. I think Skyfall is one of my favorite Bonds. I think I'm talking to a previous episode about how I like big, silly, over the top Bonds, and Skyfall comes pretty close. Skyfall does a lot of what I want, what I like, and I just had a good time watching it. And yeah, it looks amazing. It's just a really solid movie, and I have a good time watching it. Star Trek Into Darkness just didn't work for me on almost any level, and I have such a connection to the original series characters. I love them so much, and I just nothing about this was interesting. It was, and I love Benedict Cumberbatch like more than anything. And he was so boring in this. Mm-hmm. And it was one of those movies that I walked out of it and immediately forgot everything about it, because it was so unmemorable, and it felt like it was playing too hard trying too hard to do all this fan service stuff. And so it wasn't like really establishing its own story very much. Right. And it was, I don't know, it didn't seem self-contained enough to be an interesting story. And it just was not fun. And Star Trek movies should probably be fun. And so I'm gonna vote Skyfall. I don't think Star Trek Into Darkness succeeded even for me as an original series Trekkie.
Yeah, no, it really didn't. I mean, I went into I go into all the Star Trek films really expecting to like them, and you know, I have paid my dues to the franchise in order to be able to extract a lot out of the fan service that they put in there. Mm-hmm. The service is there for me. But yeah. This one, it went too far. Like, it actually profaned the legacy of the film that it was remaking. Like, I was really kind of offended by it. And then the whole weird thing with the Tribbles, and then it did the weird thing where it reversed Spock's death with Kirk's death. And like, it did all of these really weird things that were both fan, they were intended to be fan service, but to be like, oh, well, this is just like that scene in Star Trek II. But it didn't really have a strong function in the plot.
No. And
also it made Star Trek II irrelevant. Like the whole point of this reboot, what they did, they rebooted Star Trek in such a way that we didn't have to throw away the old Star Trek films, right? They built into the Star Trek with Chris Pine the whole deal with the time travel and the alternate universes in such a way that all of the old Star Trek films still exist. This is now just another thing. But does that now mean that all of the films are going to start to duplicate themselves? Right. Like, that was the premise that this film started to propose. Like, oh, crap. So, you know, Star Trek, is the next Star Trek film going to be like Star Trek 3? Like, it was really weird. Yeah. I was very disappointed by it. With Skyfall, I rewatched Skyfall like every 3 or 4 months. I think it's brilliant. I think that the more I watch it, the more the plot holes become more clear. Mm-hmm. I think that precisely the number of times that James Bond has been shot is sloppily dealt with. He's shot twice in Skyfall, but you only see one bullet hole in him, and it's like a huge plot point. So I don't understand what happened to Moneypenny's bullet. Okay, I'll talk to the screenwriters offline about that. I'm definitely voting Skyfall here. I think that what it does best is that it contributes to the franchise without being a sequel, without being too conscious of its responsibility within the franchise, so that it can still tell a compelling story. It can still push James Bond's legacy through the myth of James Bond's family and what it means to be of service to country. That continues. And I think that it did a tremendous service to the franchise.
All right. So Skyfall is going to beat Star Trek Into Darkness. And that's going to be a wrap for this episode of Flick Fights. But as always, you can follow our chart's progress and find us as Flick Fights on Flickchart. And you can follow us on Twitter at Flick Fights, and follow us on Facebook. And if you want to be a future guest on the show, or you want to send us any kind of feedback, just send us an email to flickfights@flickchart.com. And from all of us at Flick Fights, thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you soon.